husband. Why? Because by discussing the situation with each of them, one can rapidly see that they share the traits of the acute, successful, randomness fool, who, in addition, operates in the most random of environments. What is more worrisome is that their bosses and employers share the same trait. They, too, are permanently out of the market. We will see throughout this book what characterizes the trait. Again, there may not be a clear definition for it, but you can recognize it when you see it. No matter what John and Carlos do, they will remain fools of randomness. A review of Market Fools of Randomness, Constance. Most of the traits partake of the same table we explored with the right column, left column confusion, how they are fooled by randomness. Here now is a brief outline of them. An overestimation of the accuracy of their beliefs in some measure, either economic, Carlos, or statistical, John. They never considered that the fact that trading on economic variables has worked in the past may have been merely coincidental, or, perhaps even worse, that economic analysis was fit to past events to mask the random element in it. Consider that of all the possible economic theories available, one can find a plausible one that explains the past or a portion of it. Carlos entered the market at a time when it worked, but he never tested for periods when markets did the opposite of sound economic analysis. There were periods when economics failed traders, and others when it helped them. The U.S. dollar was overpriced, i.e., the foreign currencies were undervalued, in the early 1980s. Traders who used their economic intuitions and bought foreign currencies were wiped out. But later, those who did so got rich. Members of the first crop were bust. It is random. Likewise, those who shorted Japanese stocks in the late 1980s suffered the same fate. Few survived to recoup their losses during the collapse of the 1990s. Toward the end of the last century, there was a group of operators called macro traders who dropped like flies with, for instance, legendary, rather lucky, investor Julian Robertson closing shop in 2000 after having been a star until then. Our discussion of survivorship bias will enlighten us further, but clearly there is nothing less rigorous than their seemingly rigorous use of economic analyses to trade. A tendency to get married to positions. There is a saying that bad traders divorce their spouse sooner than abandon their positions. Loyalty to ideas is not a good thing for traders, scientists, or anyone. The tendency to change their story. They become investors for the long haul when they are losing money, switching back and forth between traders and investors to fit recent reversals of fortune. The difference between a trader and an investor lies in the duration of the bet and the corresponding size. There is absolutely nothing wrong with investing for the long haul, provided one does not mix it with short-term trading. It is just that many people become long-term investors after they lose money, postponing their decision to sell as part of their denial. No precise game plan ahead of time as to what to do in the event of losses. They simply were not aware of such a possibility. Both bought more bonds after the market declined sharply, but not in response to a predetermined plan. Absence of critical thinking expressed an absence of revision of their stance with stop losses. Middle-brow traders do not like selling when it is even better value. They do not consider that perhaps their method of determining value is wrong, rather than the market failing to accommodate their measure of value. They may be right, but perhaps some allowance for the possibility of their methods being flawed was not made. For all his flaws, we will see that Soros seems rarely to examine an unfavorable outcome without testing his own framework of analysis. And finally, denial. When the losses occurred, there was no clear acceptance of what had happened. The price on the screen lost its reality in favor of some abstract value. In classical denial mode, the usual, "this is only the result of liquidation," distress sales, was proffered. They continuously ignored the message from reality. How could traders who made every single mistake in the book become so successful? Because of a simple principle concerning randomness. This is one manifestation of the survivorship bias. We tend to think that traders were successful because they were good. Perhaps we have turned the causality on its head. We consider them good just because they make money. One can make money in the financial markets totally out of randomness. Both Carlos and John belonged to the class of people who benefited from a market cycle. It was not merely because they were involved in the right markets. It was because they had a bent in their style that closely fitted the properties of the rallies experienced in their market during the episode. They were dip buyers. That happened, in hindsight, to be the trait that was the most desirable between 1992 and the summer of 1998, in the specific markets in which the two men specialized. Most of those who happened to have that specific trait over the course of that segment of history dominated the market. Their score was higher, and they replaced people who, perhaps, were better traders. Naive evolutionary theories. The stories of Carlos and John illustrate how bad traders have a short and medium-term survival advantage over good traders. Next, we take the argument to a higher level of generality. One must be either blind or foolish to reject the theories of Darwinian self-selection. However, the simplicity of the concept has drawn segments of amateurs, as well as a few professional scientists, into blindly believing in continuous and infallible Darwinism in all fields, which includes economics. The biologist Jacques Monod bemoaned a couple of decades ago that everyone believes himself an expert on evolution. The same can be said about the financial markets. Things have gotten worse. Many amateurs believe that plants and animals reproduce on a one-way route toward perfection. Translating the idea in social terms, they believe that companies and organizations are, thanks to competition and the discipline of the quarterly report, irreversibly heading toward betterment. The strongest will survive, the weakest will become extinct. As to investors and traders, they believe that by letting them compete, the best will prosper and the worst will go learn a new craft, like pumping gas or, sometimes, dentistry. Things are not as simple as that. We will ignore the basic misuse of Darwinian ideas in the fact that organizations do not reproduce like living members of nature. Darwinian ideas are about reproductive fitness, not about survival. The problem comes, as everything else in this book, from randomness. Zoologists found that once randomness is injected into a system, the results can be quite surprising. What seems to be an evolution may be merely a diversion, and possibly regression. For instance, Stephen Jay Gould, who was accused of being more of a popularizer than a genuine scientist, found ample evidence of what he calls genetic noise, or negative mutations, thus incurring the wrath of some of his colleagues. He took the idea a little too far. An academic debate ensued, plotting Gould against colleagues like Dawkins, who were considered by their peers as better trained in the mathematics of randomness. Negative mutations are traits that survive in spite of being worse, from the reproductive fitness standpoint, than the ones they replaced. However, they cannot be expected to last more than a few generations, under what is called temporal aggregation. Furthermore, things can get even more surprising when randomness changes in shape, as with regime switches. A regime switch corresponds to situations when all of the attributes of a system change to the point of its becoming unrecognizable to the observer. Darwinian fitness applies to species developing over a very long time, not observed over a short term. Time aggregation eliminates much of the effects of randomness. Things, I read noise, balance out over the long run, as people say. Owing to the abrupt rare events, we do not live in a world where things converge continuously toward betterment. nor do things in life move continuously at all. The belief in continuity was ingrained in our scientific culture until the early 20th century. It was said that nature does not make jumps. People quote this in well-sounding Latin. Natura non facit saltus. It is generally attributed to the 18th century botanist Linnaeus, who obviously got it all wrong. It was also used by Leibniz as a justification for calculus, as he believed that things are continuous no matter the resolution at which we look at them. Like many well-sounding, make-sense types of statements, such dynamics made perfect intellectual sense. It turned out to be entirely wrong, as it was denied by quantum mechanics. We discovered that, in the very small, particles jump, discreetly, between states. They do not slide between them. Can evolution be fooled by randomness? We end this chapter with the following thought. Recall that someone with only casual knowledge about the problems of randomness would believe that an animal is at the maximum fitness for the conditions of its time. This is not what evolution means. On average, animals will be fit, but not every single one of them, and not at all times. Just as an animal could have survived because its sample path was lucky, the best operators in a given business can come from a subset of operators who survived because of over-fitness to a sample path, a sample path that was free of the evolutionary rare event. One vicious attribute is that the longer these animals can go without encountering the rare event, the more vulnerable they will be to it. We said that should one extend time to infinity, then by ergodicity, that event will happen with certainty. The species will be wiped out. For evolution means fitness to one and only one time series, not the average of all the possible environments. By some viciousness of the structure of randomness, a profitable person like John, someone who is a pure loser in the long run, and correspondingly unfit for survival, presents a high degree of eligibility in the short run, and has the propensity to multiply his genes. Recall the hormonal effect on posture, and its signaling effect to other potential mates. His success, or pseudo-success, owing to its fragility, will show in his features as a beacon. An innocent potential mate will be fooled into thinking, unconditionally, that he has a superior genetic makeup, until the following rare event. Solon seems to have gotten the point, but try to explain the problem to a naive business Darwinist, or your rich neighbor across the street. Chapter 6. Skewness and Asymmetry. We introduce the concept of skewness, why the terms bull and bear have limited meaning outside of zoology. A vicious child wrecks the structure of randomness. An introduction to the problem of epistemic opacity. The penultimate step before the problem of induction. The median is not the message. The essayist and scientist Stephen Jay Gould, who for a while was my role model, was once diagnosed when he was in his 40s with a deadly form of cancer of the lining of the stomach. The first piece of information he received about his odds of making it was that the median survival for the ailment is approximately 8 months. Information he felt akin to Isaiah's injunction to King Hezekiah to put his house in order in preparation for death. Now, a medical diagnosis, particularly one of such severity, can motivate people to do intensive research, particularly those prolific writers like Gould, who needed more time with us to complete a few book projects. The further research by Gould uncovered a very different story from the information he had initially been given, mainly that the expected, i.e. average, survival was considerably higher than 8 months. It came to his notice that expected and median do not mean the same thing at all. Median means roughly that 50% of the people die before 8 months and 50% survive longer than 8 months. But those who survive would live considerably longer, generally going about life just like a regular person, and fulfilling the average 73.4 or so years predicted by insurance mortality tables. There is asymmetry. Those who die do so very early in the game, while those who live go on living very long. Whenever there is asymmetry in outcomes, the average survival has nothing to do with the median survival. This prompted Gould, who thus understood the hard way the concept of skewedness, to write his heartfelt piece, "The Median is Not the Message." His point is that the concept of median used in medical research does not characterize a probability distribution. I will simplify Gould's point by introducing the concept of mean, also called average, or expectation, as follows. By using a less morbid example, that of gambling. I will give an example of both asymmetric odds and asymmetric outcomes to explain the point. Asymmetric odds means that probabilities are not 50% for each event, but that the probability on one side is higher than the probability on the other. Asymmetric outcomes mean that the payoffs are not equal. Assume I engage in a gambling strategy that has 999 chances in 1,000 of making $1. We'll call it Event A, and one chance in 1,000 of losing $10,000. We'll call it Event B. My expectation is a loss of close to $9 obtained by multiplying the probabilities by the corresponding outcomes. The frequency or probability of the loss in and by itself is totally irrelevant. It needs to be judged in connection with the magnitude of the outcome. Here, A is far more likely than B. Odds are that we would make money by betting for event A, but it is not a good idea to do so. This point is rather common and simple. It is understood by anyone making a simple bet. Yet I had to struggle all my life with people in the financial markets who do not seem to internalize it. I am not talking of novices. I am talking of people with advanced degrees, albeit MBAs, who cannot come to grips with the difference. How could people miss such a point? Why do they confuse probability and expectation, that is, probability and probability times the payoff? Mainly because much of people's schooling comes from examples in symmetric environments, like a coin toss, where such a difference does not matter. In fact, the so-called bell curve that seems to have found universal use in society is entirely symmetric. More on that later. Bull and bear zoology. The general press floods us with concepts like bullish and bearish, which refer to the effect of higher, bullish, or lower, bearish, prices in the financial markets. But also we hear people saying, "I am bullish on Johnny," or "I am bearish on that guy Nassim in the back who seems incomprehensible to me," to denote the belief in the likelihood of someone's rise in life. I have to say that bullish or bearish are often hollow words with no application in a world of randomness, particularly if such a world, like ours, presents asymmetric outcomes. When I was in the employment of the New York office of a large investment house, I was subjected on occasions to the harrying weekly discussion meeting, which gathered most professionals of the New York trading room. I did not conceal that I was not fond of such gatherings, and not only because they cut into my gym time. While the meetings included traders, that is, people who are judged on their numerical performance, it was mostly a forum for salespeople, people capable of charming customers, and the category of entertainers called Wall Street economists, or strategists, who make pronouncements on the fate of the markets, but do not engage in any form of risk-taking, thus having their success dependent on rhetoric, rather than actual testable facts. During the discussion, people were supposed to present their opinions on the state of the world. To me, the meeting was pure intellectual pollution. Everyone had a story, a theory, and insights that they wanted others to share. I resent the person who without having done much homework in libraries, thinks that he is on to something rather original and insightful on a given subject matter. And I respect people.